Speaking to Brad Warner, and the book that he's going to talk about tonight is Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. And this is a really interesting book, and it's kind of funny, it's very poignant, and it teaches a lot as we talk about, as we watch his letters to his dead friend as he's traveling on these trains in Europe. So sit back, relax, and take notice, because you're going to learn a lot in this hour. Okay, so the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, you're going to release the BS that you've been holding on to, that has been holding you back. But you know, I always ask the question, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, the Men and Money book, and Masterful Choices, the Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, again, allowing you to live your life to the fullest. Now, my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. I would like for you to check me out at my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com, and I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. My guest today, Brad Warner, is the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen and numerous other titles, including It Came from Beyond Zen, Don't Be a Jerk, and Hardcore Zen. A subtle Zen teacher, he is a punk bassist, filmmaker, and popular blogger who leads workshops and retreats around the world. In addition to his books, his writings have appeared in Lion's Roar, Tricycle, Buddha Drama, and Alternative Press. He lives in Los Angeles, where he is the founder and lead teacher of the Angel City Zen Center. And you can check him out on his website, and that is hardcorezen.info. Again, hardcorezen.info. Welcome, Brad.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for coming on. You know, it's not that often that I get to speak with a Buddhist Zen. In fact, maybe about 2 months ago, I actually worked with a Buddhist monk who wanted to become a Reiki master. So we made that happen, and he was so relaxed and zen. I was just like totally relaxed and almost didn't do my job.
That's good.
Yeah, so the energy that he exhibited is wonderful. It's just like the energy of your book, Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. Why that title? How did you come up with that?
The title? Well, It wasn't actually meant to be a title. I was struggling for a title, and I just started calling the group of chapters that I had, Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen, and I don't know, it must have my editor must have seen that and thought, oh, that's a good title, because it's more of a description of what the material is. It's a series of letters written to a friend of mine who'd passed away about Zen, and so I guess it's an okay title. It's a bit of a mouthful though for people.
Yeah, but it's okay. You know, there's a lot to learn within the book. Now, your friend that you work write about, Marky Moon. You went to school with him, and you guys started a band, and he was in the band. Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, it's Well, this gets kind of revealed in the final chapter that that Marky Moon is really a composite of two people who died at about the same time at about the same age. One of them I started a band with in high school, the first punk rock band that I ever formed, and he was the drummer. And the other one was a friend who was also part of that same punk scene in Ohio, which is sort of my roots there. And he was a guy I shared a house with. And because they both died at around the same time, and their death really impacted me, they came within 3 months of each other. And both of them were cancer, and it was really devastating to me. And I was on tour in Europe when I got the news about one of their deaths, and I was in Hamburg, in Germany, and there to lead some kind of a retreat or something. I've even forgotten what it was. I think I was just speaking to some people at a center there. But I got the news of his death, and I just kind of wandered the streets of Hamburg for a while until I ended up in this pizza shop. And I sat in this pizza shop, and I keep a diary when I'm traveling. So I just wrote this thing to him. It wasn't really meant to be a letter to him, but it sort of came out that way. My little diary entry for the day was addressed directly to him. And when I started working on this book, that was in 2014. When I started working on this book last year, I looked at that letter, that diary entry, letter-like diary entry, and I thought this might be a good basis for a book, because it makes for a way to talk about Zen and the philosophy and practice that I've been involved with for 35 or more years, in a way that's very intimate, you know, because I'm talking to somebody I know about it and trying to tell him about why I do it and what it is. So, that's the story in a nutshell there.
Well, it's really a great story, and I love how in each chapter you just sit down and you take the time and you just write to your friend from your heart. And I think that's, very touching. And, some parts I just sat and read and I just started laughing because it was truly funny. And I truly love your perspective on life. So tell us, what is Buddhism?
Well, that's so hard. I was actually just reading an article today about how people don't know whether to call Buddhism a religion or not, and that seems to be a constant issue. And I even addressed it in my book, and this article I was reading was explaining why it's not a religion, but you could also, depending on your definition of religion, it either falls into the category or it doesn't. And it turns out our categories for what is are kind of loose, according to this article I read this morning, which I tend to agree with. But it's more of a practice, a way of life, and a philosophy than a religion. I don't consider myself much of a religious person. And the main thing that makes Buddhism whatever it is, this meditation practice, and of course, different kinds of Buddhism, different ways of approaching meditation, but the one I learned was the Zen school, specifically in the Soto school of Zen, which, gets divided up in little subcategories, which is a meditation about nothing. Like Seinfeld is a show about nothing. You're not trying to make things happen, become enlightened, become a better person or anything. You just actually sit for the pure sake of sitting itself, and that is a lot harder than it sounds. If you actually try something, you'll always find out you're doing something. So our practice is to constantly try not to do whatever we're attempting to do with our meditation, and just be with the purity of the experience itself, which is sort of a microcosm of life. Life contains a lot of just sitting around. So trying to get into the see the more mundane aspects of life, the aspects that we usually don't notice, and come to terms with that, and thereby have a new perspective on reality.
Okay. Now, is this sitting what you call zazen?
Yeah, zazen, yeah. It's because in Japanese all the A's are pronounced but anyway, it's just a practice of zazen. And zazen just means sitting meditation. It's a very generic word when you kind of look at it, but it in the specific form we do, it's called shikantaza, which is just a Japanese word for just sitting. But the just in just sitting is expressed by a Chinese character that's actually the image of a hammer hitting a nail. So so the idea isn't like just sitting. Oh, well, I'm just sitting, you know, I'm not doing anything else. Or I'm just sitting. It's more like only thing you're doing is sitting, like hitting the hammer on the nail, just hitting it directly and doing only that thing.
Okay, hammer and nail. I'm going like, ouch.
Okay. Well, a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is what it is, right? Now, is there a certain type of person that's attracted to the Zen Buddhism? I mean, you talked about your two friends who, you know, really make up, you know, the character in your book, and they both passed away from cancer around the same time. But you seem to have bypassed that some way. So do you think that part of the reason, besides the fact it wasn't your time, that you fall into that energy with them was because of your practice?
Well, that's an interesting idea. I don't know. You know, it's hard to speculate. But I think, as far as the type of person who gets interested in Zen, that's also hard to say. I mean, it's two difficult questions in one. I feel like I'm probably not the usual demographic that gets into Zen, because I never sort of went around, you know, thinking of myself as a spiritual person or as a particularly meditative type of person. As you read in my bio, I was and still am a bass player in a punk rock band, and it just wasn't the sort of thing that I would normally have been attracted to. But I stumbled across this teacher who I thought was really good, and followed him for a long time, and then moved to Japan and followed another teacher and studied with him. I don't know if it's I don't know if there's, you wonder about things like cancer and why they happen to certain people. Like the one person upon whom the book is based, I know his history a bit better than the other, and he had all the risk factors. You know, he did all the things you're not supposed to do, you know, the drinking and the smoking and all this other stuff. So it was almost, you know, it was a really sad thing to hear when he got his diagnosis, but it was sort of like, oh, I kind of figured you were going that way, you know. And part of the Zen practice is you're watching yourself all the time, and there is a tendency to stay away from things that are obviously causing you harm. But then again, you know, I know of two very good, very prominent Zen teachers I can think of off the top of my head who also both died of cancer. So, I don't know that it's a preventative.
Okay, well, you know, sometimes in the metaphysical arena, they say, well, if you contract or you attract cancer to you, it's because of holding anger in, or, you know, other things like that. And I was just wondering, since Zen seems to be pretty chill, that was one of the components that, in a sense, helps you from, you know, contracting a lot of things that other people may normally do, because they're not able to process the energy that they're around.
Well, that could, you know, you could have a point there. It's hard to say in a kind of a blanket way how this stuff works, but I think there is a tendency to do that. One of the things you learn if you're doing Zen practice is how to let go, and And the way you learn how to let go is then is not really by getting lessons in, you know, here's how to let go, step one, two, three. It's mm-hmm. more of you're sitting there with this sort of assignment that you've given yourself to do nothing for the next half hour. And especially if you're doing this at a retreat where you're doing this over and over again for like days at a time and doing, you know, pretty much nothing but that. The all the anger and regret and, you know, whatever else, there's a lot of stuff will come up in your mind as you are sitting. And I think if you're at all conscious of it, you quickly learn that you're going to have a terrible time at this retreat if you keep dwelling on that stuff.
Okay.
So the only practical thing to do is let it go. And it's a real powerful teacher. It's sort of like being thrown into the, you know, learning to swim by being thrown into the deep end of the pool. You know, you've got something you've got to do, and the only way you're going to get through it is just to kind of, you know, deal with the problem head on. And that's one of the greatest things I've learned from Zen practice, is just kind of having to sit with my own, as you said, BS, mm-hmm. belief system and the other thing.
Mm-hmm. The bullshit, yes.
Yeah. I didn't know if we could say that on the show.
We can say that. It's okay.
But, you know, you sit with your own stuff and you're just going, I don't like this stuff. And it sort of, most people who do it are very quickly encouraged to change their direction, because you know either that or you're gonna be miserable.
Yeah. Okay. Well, folks, we're speaking to Brad Warner. He is the author of several books, but the book we're talking about today is Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. You can check him out on his website, and that's hardcorezen.info. Again, that's hardcorezen, all one word, .info. And while you're there, do check out his store with all the books that he's written. Even some of the titles are hilarious. I haven't read them, but I'm getting that the books are funny, but have a very deep meaning behind it. So, you know, do yourself a favor and do check it out. Now, Brad, you talked a little bit about being, you know, not attached to things. What is it about, you know, Buddhist and attachment? It's like, you know, are you supposed to be truly aloof, or, you know, explain that to us.
Well, it's a good question, and it's something that there was one thing I'm kind of embarrassed, because I've been studying Buddhism for all these years, and I didn't really know this until maybe a year or two ago somebody brought it up, which is that the Sanskrit word that is usually translated as attachment in the Buddhist context has a sub-meaning or a side-meaning of fuel. So it comes from a word that originally meant fuel, like you're putting more logs on the fire or something like that. And so the Buddhist idea of attachment isn't quite what is suggested by the English word attachment. It's more of an idea of not adding more fuel to the fire that's already burning. And fire is a big metaphor, especially in early Buddhism, for the working of the mind and so forth. And so rather than this idea of not being, you know, a lot of people hear it, don't be attached, and they think it means don't love your family and don't love your puppy dog and be aloof from everything. And it's not that sort of a meaning. It's more the meaning of don't keep adding fuel to things that are already, you know, already becoming problems. You know, mm-hmm. don't keep, you know, it's like anger is one of those things. And I didn't specifically address anger in this book, but I addressed it in another one of mine, which the idea I used to have about anger is that anger was sort of beyond my control, that it was that just sort of came on you and you just had to deal with it. And I realized after working with it that in the initial stages, anger does sort of behave that way. You just sort of get angry about whatever you're angry about, and there's not much you can do. But you can stop adding fuel to it, which is something that I think most of us do habitually. I know I certainly do did more in the past than I do now. But if you just notice that you're having this habit of adding more fuel to the anger that's burning inside of you, you go, oh, well, let me see what happens if I don't add any more fuel to that, if I just let it burn until it's done, which is sometimes hard to do. But if you get the hang of it, that's real. That's really a useful skill to develop.
Yeah, it would be. Now, you recently wrote a blog, and that blog is Bottomless Wells of Misery and Anger. So it's just not anger, but it's misery and anger. So isn't that the longer that we stay angry, the more misery we create for ourselves?
Well, for sure, yeah. And good. You do your research. A lot of the interviews I get, people don't look into stuff like that. But no, that is something I just wrote recently. And the title came from something a friend of mine had said when he was trying to deal with somebody and said, oh, this person is just a bottomless well of anger and misery. And I've known people like that, and it's you can kind of get into that. And in a way, it's sort of understandable, because if you look at life in a certain way, you can always find things to be miserable about, and you can always find things to be angry about. You know, you can just turn on the news if you have any lack of things you want to be miserable and angry about. But that's not all of life, and a lot of people you meet have lost the balance, so they're just tilted, you know, towards that direction to where everything is just a source of misery and anger. And and you can't even argue with a person like that logically, because they can always say, well, I'm right, because A, B, and C are happening, and that makes me angry. And you go, well, yeah, that's true. But if you stick with that anger, as you said, you're just adding more misery to your own life. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, there's not that much you can do about the things that make you angry. I mean, just in a practical level, you know, I can't change the government. I can't change the gas prices, you know, or I can't, you know, whatever else it is that you happen to be angry about. So a better response is to just kind of let the things be that you can't do anything about. You know, do whatever you can to change whatever you can. I mean, it's all really obvious advice, but some of us just don't learn it for some reason. I count myself as one of those people who, without this practice, I probably wouldn't have learned that either. You know, because I'm inclined to be, you know, a bottomless well of anger and misery. That's sort of the way I was going in life before I encountered this practice.
Well, I think a lot of people are bottom as well of misery and anger, but they just don't realize it, and that's why life doesn't necessarily play out the way that they expect it to.
Sure.
You talk about in the book a concept of some people believe that there is like a spiritual bypassing, that you're just supposed to like let things go. Could you talk to the audience about that, please?
Yeah, I wasn't really familiar with this term spiritual bypassing until I started saying some things, and then people said, oh, you're talking about spiritual bypassing. And I was like, oh, I didn't know there was a word for that. But and so I don't claim to be an expert in the concept, but there's a kind of way that people will take a spiritual path as a way to avoid, you know, life, you know, so everything kind of gets shunted into this area of spirituality for them, and you're just kind of ignoring things that you probably shouldn't ignore. So it's sort of, you know, then it's sort of a weird thing, because on the one hand you're taught to kind of let everything go, but on the other hand, of course, there are things you can't let go. I always, people think that Zen advocates a kind of complacent attitude, but it's not complacent. You know, it's not, you're not just trying to kind of let everything be as it is exactly. I mean, in Zen practice, in Zazen practice, what you're doing is letting everything be as it is for the 30 minutes that you're sitting. But when you get up off the cushion, you'll often realize, oh, there's something I got to fix in my life. And I've had that happen a lot of times where I'm just going, oh, well, yeah, I sat for 30 minutes being, you know, angry about this thing. Maybe I need to go deal with that. So there's a kind of a fine line between letting everything go and just using the practice as an excuse to avoid dealing with things.
Okay. Now, one of the letters that you wrote is titled Truth versus Buddhism. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people, it sort of comes out of trying to explain what I do in life to my, you know, my selected audience of my dead friend. My feeling is that what I got interested in Buddhism for was as a way to approach a kind of greater truth. And I think Buddhism is interesting as a kind of method or a framework to work on accepting and understanding the truth. But it has its limitations, and I'm certainly not a total convert to everything that goes under the heading of Buddhism. I feel like my commitment is much more to the truth, and if there's a conflict between truth and Buddhist doctrine, well, I'm going to have to go with truth over Buddhist doctrine. And that's kind of what that chapter is about. I don't want to get so enamored with the religious aspects of this practice that I let it overshadow a greater truth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know that much about Buddhism. I already shared with you my experience, but let me ask a couple of questions. Number one, when I was reading the book, I came across Four Noble Truths, or
yeah,
Truths. I love to play on that. Could you share with us what the four noble or noble truths are?
Thanks. I'm thanking you for liking that joke, because at first I thought, oh, that joke is so dumb, I can't put it in there. But my editor liked it, and you liked
it.
Great. So I'm like, okay, it's just one of those dumb jokes that works. But the original or the way they're usually spoken of in English is as the Four Noble Truths, and it's a translation of a Sanskrit term, but it's supposedly the first thing that the Buddha said in his capacity as the Buddha, because he was born a prince and had a life of luxury, and then he left behind that life of luxury to go and meditate and study and practice, and after several years of trial and error, he felt he'd found the best sort of practice, and then he started talking about it. And the first thing he's supposed to have said in that capacity was an explanation of the Four Noble Truths, which is normally given as all life is suffering, the cause of suffering is desire. If you end desire, you can end suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is basically a path of ethical action that is supposed to lead to getting rid of desire. The thing about that is my teacher, my main Zen teacher, the one in Japan who ordained me, he didn't like the way the Four Noble Truths were usually expressed, either in English or in Japanese, because he thought, well, you know, all life isn't suffering. I mean, if you say all life is suffering, I could point out a bunch of things that I do every day that aren't suffering at all, you know. And if you say suffering is caused by desire, well, you have to have certain desires. If you didn't have the desire to eat or breathe, you know, you wouldn't go very far. And desire just sort of naturally arises. So he had a kind of a slightly different take, which is really complicated to go into. But it kind of adds up to the same thing, is that there's a kind of a, it's an, it's, it's addressing this idea that in life we have suffering, and what can we do about it in practical terms instead of sort of raging against it or denying it, you know, accepting that there's a certain amount of suffering in life and trying to see where it comes from moment by moment as it arises. And yeah, so that's the Four Noble Truths, something like that.
Okay, well, I love how you explain that. Talk to me a moment about the Buddhist concept of karma.
Ooh, that one's always a tough one. One of the things that comes up with karma is that before I even talk about karma, my approach to karma is that I only apply karma to myself. You know, the idea of karma is something that I encounter in my life, and I don't look at other people's lives and go, oh, well, you have that karma, ha, ha, ha. You know, because a lot of people get very offended by that. But there is this idea that it isn't really unique to Buddhism. It kind of goes through most Indian philosophies that it's kind of scientific. You know, in the realm of the physical sciences, we see that cause and effect is absolute. You know, there's never, nothing ever happens without something sort of causing that thing to happen. And sometimes it's hard to discern exactly what caused the thing to happen, but you can always count on that there is a cause, that things just don't spontaneously just, you know, happen. And karma extends that to the realm of I don't even, you know, I'm not going to say spirit because so many people have funny ideas about that, but it is in the spiritual realm, in the realm of your mind and the interactions that you have with others. This cause and effect stuff is also taking place. So if you take an action which is motivated by anger or greed or hatred or any of that stuff, you can expect to have a result also caused by anger, greed, or hatred, and that result is usually unpleasant. So your best bet is not to act out of those sorts of motivations and to act in a way that is beneficial to others as much as possible, and you'll have a better life. And I think that's simply, I think that's all that karma is, you know, and if you extend it out into kind of other speculative realms, you only cause a problem. So I usually look at it in terms of myself, like, what am I doing now? And is this thing I'm doing now motivated by something selfish or acquisitive or greedy or angry or hurtful? And if it is, I better not do that, not only because it's not nice, but because it'll smack me in the face soon enough.
Yes. And folks, he has a wonderful story, or I guess I should call it letter, in his book regarding karma. And he talks about Three Stooges and Moe and Curly.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to give it away because I want folks to go get the book, but it's hilarious, but it really drives the point home. Okay. So if you are wondering about karma at all, buy the book for just that, okay, because it's extremely, extremely insightful. Brad,
well, thank you.
You're welcome. Talk to us about the concept of the non-self.
Ooh, yeah, that's another deep one. That's one of the unique aspects of Buddhism is this idea of non-self, and it's expressed in an Indian term, anatta or anatman, which is hard to translate, but basically you have this idea of a much older idea in Indian philosophy that there was something called atman within each person, and it's very similar to the Christian idea of a soul, so that there's this sort of immaterial something that sits somewhere in your body and moves the body around and makes everything happen, and that's the real you, and you're not really your body. Well, the Buddhists had this idea that there was no itself. And this gets really complicated because it's not saying that all of the aspects that you consider to be, to add up to yourself don't exist. If you have a personality and you have a unique social security number and you have the fact that you like chocolate and don't like strawberry, et cetera, and those things are all true, but they don't add up to a kind of immutable something that is you forever and ever. That what's really going on is constantly changing and constantly in relationship with other things. And this separation that you feel between me, you know, as the individual self and the rest of the world is actually a bit of a mistake. You know, there is a way of seeing things that way, and it's not necessarily entirely false to see things that way, but there's something much bigger going on, which is more that we are each individual processes within a larger system, is one way I like to think of it. And mm-hmm. and the larger system is the thing that is really happening. You know, and you could call that God or something like that if you're inclined to do so, but mm-hmm. it's less. So it trips people up when they hear this idea of no self, because they kind of think, well, I obviously have a self, and that's true, but maybe the self isn't quite what we imagine it to be.
Okay. Art, you're a Soto Zen priest. Are there different flavors, if you will, of Buddhism? And if so, main differences, I guess?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. If you think about it, most of us in the West, in the United States, North America, know about Christianity. And Christianity started about 2,000 years ago. Well, Buddhism started out about 500 years before Christianity, and you know how many versions of Christianity there are. You know, there's some versions that are very orthodox, like the Catholic Church and maybe the Presbyterians or something like that. And there's some versions that are really out there, like the Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses and things, you know, like that. I'm not trying to disparage those, but they're quite divergent, you know, forms. So the same thing is true of Buddhism, and in fact, possibly even more so, because it had a 500-year head start. So there's all sorts of different versions of Buddhism, and they do have certain things in common. But the different forms of Buddhism are so different that the initial researchers, they were mostly British, who were trying to understand Indian religions and religions in China and places like that, they didn't recognize them as being, you know, for the first few decades of researching these religions, they didn't recognize them as being the same religion. It took a while for them to figure out, oh, it's the same. These are the same religions. So, mm-hmm. The Zen form is kind of a form which tends to be extremely into being rational, and it doesn't, there's a certain sort of cosmology, you might say, that's sort of in the background there, but the Zen folks don't really worry too much about that. You know, about the origin of the universe and all that stuff tends to be kind of like something they don't even want to talk about. It also tends to be very kind of rational. Like Dogen, who is the person who founded the sect that I mostly studied in, or that I really studied in pretty much exclusively, he has this famous essay where he talks about deep belief in cause and effect, which is really kind of saying we have to be rational about things. We have to kind of look at things in an almost scientific way and say, well, everything is caused by something, without worrying about belief systems or you know, the supernatural. Dogen's kind of funny because he doesn't deny, he's not like some sort of ancient Richard Dawkins who's denying and making fun of the supernatural. He just says that even things that we might consider supernatural also have to behave according to the laws of cause and effect. So you can't get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Zen. And of course, the other forms of Buddhism often get much more like religions. You know, you can find forms of Buddhism where Buddha is worshipped as a god, mm-hmm. but in the Zen form, most of us would just consider Buddha to have been a human being who was an extraordinary human being and a human being worth studying and listening to, but not any sort of a divinity. So, you know, you have a whole spectrum of Buddhisms.
Okay, well, that's cool. Now, when we go to your website, hardcorezen.info, what are we going to find there?
Well, it started off as a blog, and the blog is still on there, and I still update it usually once or twice a week. But there are also, links to the YouTube channel, which I'm having a lot of fun with. I started that about 2 years ago. People mm-hmm. kept saying, you should do a YouTube channel, and I thought, oh, that's weird. But then I started, and I'm really enjoying doing these little YouTube videos. There's links to get the books. We unfortunately can't match Amazon's prices on the books. We sell them more for the retail price. But the caveat is I sign every one that, and I'll personalize it for you if you want, that you buy directly from me. So there's stuff like that and some links to some writings by my teachers and things like that, too.
Okay, well, cool. Brad, what is the future of Zen in the West as you see it?
I don't know. I think it's going to continue. Buddhism in general and Zen specifically are going to continue to become more popular. And that has good points and bad points. You know, and the good points is that I think there's a lot that we in the West can learn from these philosophies and practice. And the bad point is that as it becomes more popular, you know, you're going to have people jumping in who are going to see an opportunity. You know, we've already had a few rather unfortunate cases of people sort of masquerading as Zen teachers who really weren't and kind of ended up leading a lot of people in bad directions. But that's just sort of an outlier case. I think most people are very sincere. So I think we're going to see it continue to become more and more influential on American society and European society than it is now. And, you know, it's hard to say how that'll go. But I think in time, Buddhism will become one of the sort of major religions of the United States and Europe where people will go, okay, you know, Christianity, Judaism, you know, Buddhism. Mm-hmm. What shape that Buddhism will take is hard to predict.
Okay, that's fair. I got to ask you a personal question. When you're out
sure.
and people are around you, do they seem to be more calm the longer they stay in your presence?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I try to be very patient with people. So, you know, I don't know what kind of effect I have on them. I've known some people who I have the opposite effect on, but those are sort of fewer. But I don't know. I just try to treat people fairly, and then hope that fairness comes back to me in some way. And it's hard to say, you know.
Well, I don't know.
People do, you know, come around.
I'm like feeling your energy while we're talking, and you know, just like working with that Zen priest, the other one that I told you about with the Reiki, it's just like calming and soothing, and you pay attention, you know. So, congratulations, because I think you have an effect on people that you really are not aware of.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to say because I don't, you know, of course, I only see the people I'm around when I'm around them, so I don't know what they're like the rest of their lives.
Right.
So it's hard to say. But thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, we're almost at the end of our time. What pearl of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience today?
Pearl of wisdom.
Yeah,
I don't know. Well, two books ago I wrote a book called Don't Be a Jerk, and that was my version of a saying that Dogen had, which was don't it translates to something much drier, like don't enact wrongdoing or something like that. But it's basically, he says the biggest lesson that you can get from Buddhism is don't do the wrong thing. And we kind of all know that sort of, but we tend to let our emotions and things carry us away. And if you become more aware of how you're being in any given moment, you can learn not to be a jerk. So maybe my advice is don't be a jerk.
Okay. Love it. Absolutely love it. Well, you know, Brett, I want to thank you for being with me today, and I want to thank the audience for listening as we collectively get over it. The divine in me honors the divine in you. Folks, when you're ready to raise your vibration and shift your energy, you can give me a call. Intuitive consultations, 30 minutes or longer, are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make that call. 888-240-6057. And before I go, Brett, tell us about your center in Los Angeles.
It's called the Angel City Zen Center. Los Angeles means City of Angels, so that's why we named it that. And it's just a little place. We found a house in Echo Park, the Echo Park neighborhood here, and started a little center there. And everybody's welcome to come. It's not certainly not the most popular Zen center in LA, but it's the best. So
there you go.
So come on down.
Okay, and folks, he does have events on his website that are happening at the Angel City Zen Center, so you can definitely check that out. And folks, remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the master choice of becoming more Zen. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.